I'm gonna go to Mexico, find a place no one knows, somewhere peaceful and slow. Gonna go to Mexico. Take my old pawn shop guitar. Oh, I won't need my car. I'll leave it near a Texas town. Don't matter if it's ever found. I'm gonna go to Mexico, find a place no one knows, somewhere peaceful and slow. Gonna go to Mexico. Cross the border late at night, swim away from the Texas lights, throw my money in a garbage can. End my watch in the Rio Grande. I'm gonna go to Mexico, find a place no one knows, somewhere peaceful and slow. Gonna go to Mexico. I can dream and I can sing, do anything I please. Timeless is the moment, I do believe. Tell my mama and my dad, life's too short to live it so sad. From children's lullabies, too quickly life goes by. I'm gonna go to Mexico, find a place no one knows, somewhere peaceful and slow. Gonna go to Mexico. I'm gonna go to Mexico, find a place no one knows, somewhere peaceful and slow. Gonna go to Mexico, go to Mexico.
That was going to go to Mexico by Bob Rafkin. I'm joined by Bob Rafkin here at Resonance Towers. Bob, going to go to Mexico. We should really, I suppose, talk about why you're here and all that sort of stuff. But first of all, I mean, let's refer back to that song in particular. I couldn't really decipher what the intention was behind the lyrics. But one, it sounded a bit like a sort of extended suicide letter in a way. Is going to Mexico a kind of euphemism?
Not at all.
Okay, all right. But is it in a sense? Is it, you know? I mean, were you talking expressively about border politics, or am I reading it wrong and it's purely metaphorical?
Okay, what it's about, I used to live in Southern California, near the in Los Angeles, not real far from the border, from Baja, Mexico.
Okay, I know. Yeah.
The border town there is San Diego, on the U.S. side. Very upscale, party time, out in the tennis court, all that kind of stuff.
I've been in La Jolla many times,
Okay, then you get into, then you cross the border into Tijuana. It's a stark difference. But it's actually very beautiful when you get further down in Baja. And we have a problem now in the states of illegals coming across, not in Baja, though they do there too, But the main problem is the Texas-Mexico border, the Rio Grande River. That's where they predict there's something like 150,000 illegals coming over every month.
Yeah, I saw I think I saw a news report about this a few months ago. Yeah,
it's a real big problem. So you got 150,000 people jumping in the river from Mexico coming in the U.S., and nobody goes the other way.
Yeah.
That's what this song is about. This is about somebody who jumps in the river and escapes to Mexico.
Okay, yeah, that's what I figured. In my notes, I put border politics inverted.
It's sort of tongue-in-cheek in a way, but also I think within the song is kind of a longing to get away from our high-tech, pressured society, you know, someplace where there's... where you can breathe, you know, and there's a lot of beauty in Mexico. I mean, we kind of
possibly more humanity as well, I would imagine.
Yeah. So that's what this song is about. It's somebody who just throws his money away, you know, abandons his car and jumps in the river and goes to Mexico.
And that song is taken from Bob's latest album, which is the songs of Bob Rafkin. And I suppose what we should do is talk about you a little bit, Bob. For those that aren't familiar with your name or your work. So you've been pretty much proactive since when, the early 60s, the mid-60s?
Mid-60s.
So you're a New Yorker originally, yeah?
Yes, I am.
But you grew up in Washington, D.C., which is not too far away, I guess.
Yeah, just a couple hours, you know, not far.
And Cleveland and Philadelphia, looking at your biography.
All over. My dad was a fugitive, so...
Oh, really?
No, I'm kidding. We just moved around a lot. And then when I was, Cleveland, Ohio, and Columbus, Ohio, went to school there. And then Philadelphia, and then I left home and moved back to New York City, lived in the Village, Greenwich Village for a while.
Is it, become a bit of a sort of almost mythological kind of place, Greenwich Village in the mid-60s in a way? I mean, is it as it's painted historically? I mean, did it quite match up to how people kind of fondly reminisce about it now? I mean, was it quite a vibrant and... intriguing place to live, or was it kind of like how it is now, but less homogenized and so on?
Well, I'm not real familiar with how it is now. I've been there a couple times. And now a lot of the mom-and-pop little businesses are gone, and all the corporate little places and stuff like that. But in the 60s, it was remarkable. I don't think people can relate to what it was. It was very remarkable. It was during a creative musical renaissance. You know, Dylan and also the Beatles doing their thing too. You know, so many creative people at the time, and that was reflected and amplified participated in by people in the Village. You know, it was just amazing. It was just amazing. There were so many creative people there then.
You seem to be a real synergy between the arts. You had a lot of poets working with the music, a lot of artists working with music and so on. And
all sorts of things.
Artists would obviously lease their loft for performances and musical performances and so on. So,
not that so much. There was just so much out on the streets, and there were a lot of... I lived right on Bleecker and McDougal in the West Village, Bleecker Street. And right down the street from where I was, the Village Gate, at the Bitter End... and then I can't remember the name of the place, but there was a theater that Frank Zappa rented. Frank Zappa, Mothers of Invention at the time. That was his group at the time, and they were there for about a half a year or maybe more. I don't know. And they played every night at this place, and they were incredible. And just to walk in there and now you look back and you realize how historic it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was really amazing. I mean, there wasn't a night that you couldn't see great. You know, great performers.
I mean, was it something that was palpable to you at the time, or did you just perceive it as normal? It's only in hindsight that you realize what an exciting, kind of vibrant time it was.
I had a sense that there was something really fantastic going on, the main thing was at the moment it was really incredible. It was so much energy, so you got caught up in the energy, you know, but that whole movement, coming out of the hippie movement into electric. Folk music going into electric, and groups like the Love and Spoonful, which came out of acoustic groups, and the Birds, and even Dylan going electric. So it was that in between place, and it was starting to seep into mainstream music. But it was really it was extremely remarkable, and I sensed it then. What I really sensed was once it was gone, you realized the power of it. But in a way, the power of it, maybe it wasn't that powerful because it disappeared or it just couldn't be sustained. It was very much connected to with the civil rights movement, a lot of things going on. The music, you know, We Shall Overcome and Joan Baez doing her thing and all that kind of stuff. Phil Oakes out there, you know, protest singers. But it was amazing.
And we're talking, what, around about 65, 66 or slightly earlier?
No, about 66, I think. So, 65, 66.
So Vietnam was sort of yet to sort of reach its peak, I suppose, for many young Americans.
Yeah, that was still to come.
Yeah.
Just a few years.
Okay, well, let's have a short break, and we'll hear something from an instrumental album, which is a collection of instrumentals, Velvet Hand, and we're going to hear a tune called Shelby Lane, which I believe is the name of your daughter.
That's right.
Is she named after a country lane anywhere, or not?
I named her after the song.
I see.
No,
okay.
No, I named the song after her.
All right.
And it's Lane, L-A-Y-N-E.
Is it?
Yes.
It's a typo on your CD sleeve, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, I think there was.
No, there's not. No, it's L-A-Y-N-E.
Yeah, but on the first run of those CDs, I couldn't believe that we spelled her name wrong. We left out the Y.
Oh, poor girl.
It's correct on there.
Quel âge is she? What age is she, Bob?
She's a beautiful little thing.
What age is she?
She's 11.
Oh, she's 11, right. So she's old enough to listen to this program.
Yeah, and also to read and see if we spelled her name right.
Right. Yeah. Okay, I hope she hasn't got too many identity problems. Here we go, with Shelby Lane. So, this is Resonance 104.4 FM. My name is Richard Thomas. I'm in conversation with a singer-songwriter and guitarist, I suppose, as well. You're an instrumental guitarist.
Yes.
And won a number of awards, I believe, Bob, for your finger-picking. Where did you get... 1994 winner of the Florida Guitar Fingerpicking Championship. Any other plaudits?
As a writer, as a songwriter, but I didn't enter very many guitar things.
Because, okay.
In fact, I didn't enter very many other things because after a while you realize that's not what it's about. It's no fun to be scrutinized. You just want people to enjoy what you do. Mm-hmm. You know, and when you're up there and people are critiquing you, you get in a really weird mindset, and then you start thinking about that all the time, and I had to get away from that, so I don't even enter those things anymore.
Yeah.
I just rather get up and play. Either people like it or they don't, but I'm not rated. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'm not judged, you know, at least not that I know of.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose there's a thin line between being completely self-aware and hyper-self-conscious, and that is obviously going to inhibit you at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
We just heard Selby Lane, which is off The Velvet Hand, which is a collection of instrumentals by Bob Rafkin, featuring Nestor Torres on flute, John Marsden on keyboards, Bob Rafkin on guitar, bass, and accordion, Cadillac Cardarelli on drums and percussion, Doug Stock on pedal steel, and John Henry Gates on fiddle. And it was recorded at the Music Room. How do you work? Do you usually use a studio elsewhere, or do you record at home now?
Yeah, I have my own studio. That's the Music Room.
Okay, all right, yeah.
And that's where I do everything.
Is it just for you, or do you kind of use it commercially? Or?
Now I do. When it started out, it was just for me. And then as I was getting my CDs around, I started getting phone calls. And, where did you do this? This sounds really nice. Mm. And I did it in my own studio. Oh, really? Well, can I come and record there? It was that kind of a thing. So then I figured, how much am I going to charge? So I figured out a whole thing. And, you know, in fact, I'm building a new studio that's supposed to be done, hopefully by shortly after I get back to the States.
Okay, right.
And then I'm going to hit that, you know, real hard as far as recording, you know.
Okay.
At least that's my intention.
Yeah, you know? So it'll be a sort of chain of studios.
The Music Room, yeah.
Mm, okay.
It'll be like the Music Room. I'll have T-shirts, sort of like, you know, like the Hard Rock, it'll say Music Room, London.
Yeah.
Music Room,
like a kind of
Paris. Yep. Music Room, Baghdad, you know?
Baghdad, I think that'd be the one. Yeah. It's a good soundproof in there, I think, given the carpet bombing, yeah.
Yeah, you'll need it, yeah.
I was going to ask you, presumably you take quite a keen interest in the any wooden structures in the building of these studios, because I believe that for a while you kind of, you know, sort of gave up on music in a way, and well, I don't know if you gave up on it, but gave up on it professionally at least, and started to do woodworking. Is that correct?
Well, I not only gave up on music, I gave up on listening to everything. I plugged my ears up so I couldn't hear anything for 8 years, and I started building furniture.
Okay, yeah.
And then I just longed to hear something,
right?
Anything.
Yeah.
And I'm just kidding. I did woodworking for a while. I built furniture, really cool freestanding hardwood furniture.
All right.
And,
okay.
And but then. When I started getting back into music, you know, you know, when you're working with saws and shit, like stuff like that, you don't want to cut a finger off.
No, true.
You know, so, you know, so I had to make a choice. So then I said, okay, no more furniture.
Yeah. Well, was it something you always did anyway as a hobby or as a young man, and then, you know, you just came back to it, or did you just totally start afresh and get, you know?
You mean the
woodworking? Yeah.
Well, I was always kind of handy with stuff, and one of my girlfriends asked me to build a piece of furniture. It's kind of bizarre. She said, oh, can you build this piece? Well, I don't know why she even asked me that now, but it was a great thing she asked me, because I built this piece of furniture and it came out really cool. And I said, oh. So then I started building other things. And then the same thing happened with the music room. Then people said, oh, can you build me something? So then I started a business, and I did that for a number of years. Mm. And that's what I did. And then I got out of it and, you know, hit the music thing again.
Okay, so you haven't had your hands near a plane or a saw for some time, then, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, can we just sort of go back to, you know, your sort of formative years musically? And you know, you found yourself in Greenwich Village, you know, joining the melee there, the sort of cultural melee there. And I believe that you were part of what's described as a campy folk rock group, which is the American Patrol, which unfortunately I will declare my ignorance of. But can you tell me?
You and almost everybody else in the world.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, how many records?
Very obscure.
Okay.
Well, we did one. Okay, the main person in that group was a singer-songwriter, David Blue, and David was kind of a, along the lines of like a Dylan. He looked a little like Dylan too, and he's a bigger guy, taller guy, and he was actually friends with Dylan. He did a couple of his own albums. I think he was on Folkways or Elektra, one of those labels. and then formed a group, the American Patrol, and we did one CD or album at the time, vinyl, and I can't remember if it was ever released. And then we broke up, and David and I both moved out to California. I moved to San Francisco, and he moved to L.A. And then eventually I moved down to L.A., and then I produced a couple of his albums.
Yeah, I mean, how did that happen? Because I know that you kind of worked as a producer on a number of projects or worked with producers quite closely on a number of different sort of projects by different artists. I mean, how did that sort of transition happen to you? You know,
well, that's a natural transition. I mean, there's a lot of players who end up producing. It's so close because you get involved in that aspect of it anyway, you know, to some degree. You know, and when you're playing in the studio, you know, you start getting, you know, having your input in the things, and you know, you have an idea of what you want, and pretty soon you're producing it. You know? So that's kind of what happened.
Yeah. In many ways, it's kind of more exciting than actually being an instrumentalist because the kind of wide objectivity you have for it, I suppose. It's kind
yeah,
of...
well, and I usually do both. I usually play on the stuff anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it's a broad, yeah, it's much broader, and you can carry through a concept because a lot of times you'll musically come up with something as an instrumentalist, and then when it's mixed, sometimes it's not mixed the way that you hear it, you know. But when you produce it, then you can, you know, make it the way you want.
Another thing I noticed that you kind of became friendly with, and in fact, you know, kind of became a colleague of Phil Oakes as well, who is a bit of a legend, I suppose, on the politicized American folk scene, if we can call it that, from that period.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You worked with Eric Jacobson, who was also working with Loving Spoonful too. What was going on there? What were you?
Well, I met Eric in the Village, right. And he was producing Loving Spoonful. He also produced Tim Hardin. Remember Tim Hardin?
Yes.
You know, If I Were a Carpenter, it was his. Yeah. And Eric asked me if I wanted to produce records with him, and we moved out to San Francisco. Mm. Beautiful, beautiful San Francisco. Mm. I was out there with him for a year, then I moved to L.A. But he also produced a group that was kind of obscure called the Sopwith Camel.
Yeah.
Do you know of them?
I know the name. I'm sure I've seen those albums around in bargain stores.
Yeah.
Yes.
I heard that they just reformed.
Oh, really? Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, this is a long time ago.
I hear the Straubs are still going or have reformed recently as well. I kind of associate them with that period, but perhaps I'm wrong.
Yeah, I think certain groups do that. I don't know what happens. I don't know if you hunger for the good old days, or you just get bored, but you forget all the arguments that you had, and you reform.
Well, it's a bit like Friends reunited.
Yeah,
I imagine looking at the Straubs, they seem to be of an age where perhaps retirement was coming.
Yeah,
and they need something to do, and there's probably a tangible market for it. So, I mean, why not?
That's
really,
probably but it, you know,
I wouldn't fancy touring much when, you know, in 30 years' time when I'm 66 or whatever it is. It strikes me as being a bit hard work, a bit different for a solo performer. And, you know, that's something you're quite proactive and you're constantly playing in the United States and the UK. Or?
Yeah, it's not that hard to do, really. I mean, and I'd rather work as a soloist.
Well, that's what I mean. I think it's easier on your own as opposed to...
Oh, yeah, because there's always that stress because the...
Well, the claustrophobia is...
Well, not that so much, but there's a lot of stressful things because the drummer always shows up late. Traditionally, it doesn't matter who the drummer is, what the band is, the drummer always shows up late. And you're always, where's the drummer? Where's that guy? Yeah, I'm kidding about that. But no, you have to... When you're doing a solo thing, you only have to be responsible and accountable for yourself. You know, so it's much easier, you know.
Yeah, you get to keep an eye on the merchandising, pay a bit more scrutiny to that and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah, so, I mean, you've been over in the UK for a number of weeks now, so where have you performed and you know, how have you found it, and do you have any intention to come back in the near future?
Let's see, I've been at the 12 Bar a couple times, the Borderline, the Troubadour, the Green Note, Hodson's, and then a couple places up in Cambridge, and in a little city called Loughborough that's has, I think, 80 letters in it that spells Loughborough. It's it's a weird spelling. Colchester. So I've been here 20 days and did 11 dates in 20 days, which is actually quite a lot. So that's enough. I'm hoarse, have a little cold. I live in Florida, and the climate change has come in a little bit, you know, I think.
Yeah.
So
Yeah, it's been rather schizoid, the weather here. But
it's been actually very beautiful. I heard like there's been record highs and stuff.
Well,
and
we're on the cusp of October. It's officially autumn. And yeah, today's the first day I've seen a kind of duck egg gray sky, really. So it was almost like the middle of summer yesterday. But let's have a short break. And I think, Bob, I've selected I'd Rather Be an Outlaw. Is that agreeable?
Yeah, that's fine.
Let's have a listen to that.
And sound of whistles, I think it's getting louder every day. They say it's coming through here, they'll take my home away. But if they try, someone's gonna pay. Lord, I've never sinned, a peaceful man I've been, living by the book in every way. But when they came this morning for the land my daddy claimed, I looked them in the eyes and said with pain, I'd rather be an outlaw. If I leave this life behind, I'm not too good at being mean. I've always acted kind. If I was an outlaw with two guns set to fight, raising Cain, I know your name, and it'll get you in the night. Riding high, riding high, riding high. They held me at gunpoint and forced me off my land. They set the cattle loose in a house aflame. I fled up to the mountains, to the top of Devil's Hill. There I swore my vengeance on those trains. Stayed awake that night, made plans to set things right. How much do they think a man can take? I've always held my dignity, fought for what belonged to me. Thought again about the words I told those men. I'd rather be an outlaw if I leave this life behind. I'm not too good at being mean. I've always acted kind. If I was an outlaw with two guns set to fight, raising Cain, I know your name, and it'll get you in the night. Riding high, riding high, riding high. Train pulled out next morning, heading down the track, gaining speed and rolling round the bend. No one saw me waiting with that stick of dynamite. No one ever saw that train again. Now I'm on the run, living by my gun, hiding from the law day to day. And even if they stop me with a bullet in my heart, Someone else will look at them and say, I'd rather be an outlaw if I leave this life behind. I'm not too good at being mean. I've always acted kind. If I was an outlaw with two guns set to fight, raising Cain, I know your name and look at you in the night. Riding high, riding high, riding high. Riding high, riding high, riding high. Riding high, riding high, riding high.
So that was I'd Rather Be an Outlaw by Bob Rafkin, taken from the LP Songs of Bob Rafkin. If you want to purchase these CDs or, in fact, even find out more about Bob, the obvious thing for you to do is to visit www.bobrafkin.com. And I'll spell that for you, just in case you're uncertain of how you spell Rafkin. It's www.bobrafkin. So, Bob, yes, I'd rather be an outlaw. Were you ever tempted to sort of, you know, pursue a criminal path? Or are we, again, talking purely metaphorically?
Well, just between you and me, I am an outlaw. No one knows that. I have a dual identity. You know, sort of like the heroes, you know? Mm-hmm. I go in a phone booth like Superman, and I turn into an outlaw.
Right, okay.
Yeah, that's my other identity. Normally, I'm mild-mannered Bob Rafkin.
Yeah.
When I go into a phone booth, I turn into a bandit.
Dressed in black, presumably, and or not
the whole thing.
Yeah,
black
yeah.
hat.
Yeah,
yeah.
Black one hat. Of those masks, like
yeah.
Zorro.
So no one will know who I am. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And I rob stores. You know.
Okay, really, any particular stores that you...
Doesn't matter. I don't discriminate. Mm. Don't discriminate
okay.
at all. Yeah.
Gun stores would be possibly good and bad to
well,
rob.
Yeah, in the States we have a lot of gun stores.
Yeah, yeah. What's the situation in Florida with gun laws? Am I wrong to think there's a slightly different... Because I know different states. I remember apparently in California someone told me that at one point you could sort of walk into a store, even like a liquor store, and buy a one-shot...
Well,
pistol for, you know, women's self-protection is how they marketed it.
You can get guns $20. Very easily over yeah. there. We have this big chain called Walmart, which I think now has seeped its way into the UK. I think it bought out one of your supermarkets.
Yeah.
So you can go into Walmart, which is a big mega superstore, gigantic thing, and you can buy your shopping, buy your groceries, buy a pair of pants, get a pair of socks, buy a shotgun. All in one place, you know. So, yeah, I'm not real keen on all of that stuff, but somehow that's the way things have been interpreted in the land of the free, that we can do that kind of stuff and buy those guns. I don't think it's a good idea, really.
No, but you never know when Armageddon's coming, do you? Do you remember the Y2K phenomenon where you had all these kind of like frontiers people?
I even
remember Time magazine publishing serious articles.
Yeah, a big scare about that. It was like the end of the world was going to happen when our technology shut down, you know, and that next day. And I guess a lot of people didn't sleep that night. I did.
Yeah, I think I was in New Zealand when it happened, expecting the worst, but nothing did. I think
nothing did.
It's one of those fin de siècle kind of situations. Talking about sort of, you know, dramatic moments in the 20th century, and I suppose one of the most dramatic moments, at least it would be for me, was you worked with Gene Vincent at some point.
Sorry to
go off topic or back on topic, but can you tell me a little bit about that, and how was it working with Gene, and what exactly did you do?
Gene, okay, first of all, Gene was, you know, very big in the 60s. He was older than I was. Apparently, there are a number of stories about this. He was in the service, and some kind of explosion happened on a submarine. This is one of the stories he would tell. And it messed up his leg, like this big explosion, and he almost lost his leg, and it wasn't right after that, and he was on drugs, and... And then another time he talked about how it happened in a car accident. It was kind of weird. I mean, you get two different stories from the same person. He was pretty weird. He was kind of schizoid, kind of would come in and out of stuff and, you know, that kind of thing. But the style, which I was trying to describe on radio, of the old rock singers, where they hold on to the microphone stand and have one leg straight behind them and the other leg bent, Remember that look?
Yeah.
He was the one who came up with that because he couldn't bend his leg.
Okay, so
he's credited with that. That's the way that was. Anyway, so I work with him in the 70s, I guess it was. Yeah, maybe he was big in the 50s. I don't know. I don't know when it was. And recorded on one of his albums. And he was the kind of a guy where, like I say, he was pretty crazy.
Mm.
But as soon as you get a microphone in front of him, he just sung like a bird. I mean, he was just beautiful. I mean, he was a great singer.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I mean, I suppose you were just playing guitar. You were playing in the backup group, yeah?
Yeah.
You also worked with the Everly Brothers, Randy Newman, and Arlo Guthrie as well.
Yeah.
I mean, again, what were you doing, and how did these kind of sort of collaborations?
I have no idea what I was doing.
I mean, you were working as an instrumentalist, presumably.
Now I work closer with Gene because we rehearsed and hung out and stuff like that. But as far as the Everly Brothers and Arlo and Randy Newman, I was hired as a studio musician. And when you do that, a lot of times you come in and lay the tracks down, you know, without the vocal.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no idea what the songs were. I never heard the songs. You just come in and play the tracks.
Yeah.
And I met them and that kind of stuff. And Randy Newman is just a regular dude. I mean, he's just, you know. And I think he was from New York. That's what I did. I did a recording in L.A., But having lived in New York, I kind of knew that mentality real well. He's just a regular guy you can hang out with.
And you were working on albums, not soundtracks or anything? Yeah.
No, those were albums. Like I say, I don't even know what albums, I don't even know what songs.
Yeah, sure.
I never heard the song. And I wasn't real good at cataloging things I played on.
Okay.
You know, they were forgotten,
Yeah. So your agent would just say, Bob, you know, we've got this today, tomorrow, and the day after.
Well, yeah, I didn't have an agent. I would just get calls on my service, you know, and go do it, you know.
Mm.
I also had a song recorded by the Byrds called Lazy Waters. It was on the last incarnation of the Byrds.
Yeah.
And I was so bad at like I say, cataloging things that I had a copy of the album and I lost it, you know, but also I didn't like their version.
Okay.
And then I went into a used record store with a used girlfriend, old girlfriend. And they said, there's your album, you know, not my copy, because actually I lived in this area. You have to picture this. I lived in this area in Los Angeles called Laurel Canyon.
Okay.
And I lived not a high altitude, but I wasn't at ground level. And so I looked out over the canyon. I had a porch that hung out over the canyon.
Mm.
And I didn't like the version of it at all. And I heard it. And I was so excited when I got the thing and put it on the record player, put the little needle on there and it started to play. I said, this is terrible. So I listened to the whole song at a courtesy and out of curiosity. And then I took it off and I turned it into a Frisbee out over the canyon, never to be seen again until this girlfriend said, oh, there's a copy of the, you got to buy this. So I bought it. And I do have a copy of it, and I haven't played it because I don't have a turntable anymore. But all of my old I have a bunch of old albums, some really cool ones.
Mm.
But now they're just kind of ballast to hold my bookshelf from falling over there at the bottom.
Yeah, you know? It's like that. I think. I suppose once you've achieved the project and actually laid the stuff down, I suppose you know, that's it. It's done for you. So you don't really care much for the material. The material.
It's
object.
True. Actually, it's true. And my own. My own CDs. When you're working on those things, you live them day and night. But as soon as I'm finished, like when we just played Shelby Lane, I'm listening. Oh, I haven't heard that for a while. Because then I just it's done. Then you let go of it. Then you're on to something else.
Mm.
You know. And also, I don't listen to my stuff. Another reason is because when I do listen to it, I can be more objective. If you obsess about it, listen over and over and over again after it's done, I mean, you don't have any point of perspective at all.
Yeah, sure.
So I just kind of let those things go, and but when I perform, my live performance is different anyway, and my songs always evolve. The new CD, Songs of Bob Rafkin, has some older songs on there that I redid, and the original versions on my other CDs. I have 7 different CDs. The original versions were done with bands, and I re-recorded them for a couple of reasons. One, I wanted an acoustic version, being the guitar, but also the songs had changed. Some of the songs had new lyrics, new parts in the songs. They were done quicker or slower, you know. So they had evolved. So I wanted to document what those songs were. And then after I did that, and that CD is only a couple months old, and I've already changed some songs again.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite an interesting process. I mean, for many people, they are making just the one artwork continuously over the period of their artistic life. But, I mean, when you say that some of these are old songs, I mean, how old are they? And how much kind of, space of there to evolve.
Well,
into
some of them date back to the 12th century.
Really? Wow.
And I wrote them.
You're very good for your age. Should we listen to Delta Lady, which is the first track off Songs of Bob Rafkin, which is your newest opus?
Great.
There's a bit of a hefty FBI anti-piracy warning there.
Yeah.
I just noticed that then.
What does it say?
FBI anti-piracy warning. But it does look rather... Department of Justice, Federal Bureau of Investigation... Warning, unauthorized reproduction of this recording is prohibited by federal law and subject to criminal prosecution.
You've never seen that before? That's a stand. I didn't have anything to do with that. That goes on a lot of.
Well, it goes on here, but I mean, obviously, you don't get the FBI one on here. It just looks slightly more Orwellian, should we say?
Yeah, but don't be afraid to pick it up. It's all right.
Okay.
It's not going to bite.
All right. Here we go, Delta Lady. And this is available from bobrafkin.com if you like what you hear.
Louisiana, your bayou waters flow south of New Orleans to the Gulf of Mexico. There lives a lady, the heat's made her so crazy. Well, her voodoo spell has taken away my soul. Green water toads, snake head and bones, chicken feet and alligator stew. Lost in your arms, captured by your charms, Delta Lady, leave the city Barlow. Swampy waters, like creepy crawlers, caught beneath a foggy yellow moon. Delta Lady, my mind is so hazy, and a sleepy mist is filling up this room. Old dogs with fleas, stuff that makes you sneeze, flying bats that hover in the night. Down on my knees, begging you please, Delta Lady, leave this city boy alone. Bayou waters flow south of New Orleans to the Gulf of Mexico. There lives a lady, the heat's made her crazy. Well, her voodoo spell has taken away my soul. Green water toads, snake head and bones, chicken feet and alligator stew. Lost in your arms, captured by your charms, Delta Lady, leave this city Barlow. 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 Delta Lady, leave this city Barlow.
So that was another tune by Bob Rafkin, off Songs of Bob Rafkin, his latest LP. And it was Delta Lady. I mean, can you give me a little bit of background on that, Bob?
Do you want the truth, or you want me to make something up?
Tell me the truth.
Okay. It's not that interesting, but it's the truth.
Okay.
When my family and I moved from California to Florida, which is where we live now, and if you picture the states, the California's on the West Coast, Southern West Coast, and Florida's on the Southern East Coast. And you take the big interstate, which is the Santa Monica Freeway, which is also Interstate 10. You take it long enough, and it just becomes Interstate 10, forgetting about the Santa Monica Freeway. Goodbye, L.A. And you keep driving and driving and driving, and you go through Louisiana. And that was the first time I had gone through Louisiana.
Mm.
And I was just so taken by all of the swampland.
Mm.
And there's this one section. I mean, as you know from the hurricanes, that Katrina, that all of that disaster, Louisiana is very low, so a lot of swamp. You know, it's all swampy, gooky green fingernails. You know, that kind of stuff. It's weird. So there was this long stretch on I-10 where at first I didn't realize it. I looked over the edge and I saw it was all swampland, but I didn't realize we were actually on a suspended road there, almost like a bridge that was traveling over this swampland. You know, and we weren't on solid ground there. And I just thought, wow, that's really something. And I remember the time of day, and I remember it was real gloomy that day, and it was almost like a mist.
Hmm.
And I thought, wow, this is really spooky. I wonder, you know. And Louisiana is also known for the voodoo and stuff like that, and that whole image. So out of that came that song, you know. And it didn't. I didn't write it right away because I was driving the car and I didn't want to crash, you know. I didn't want to pick up my guitar and let go of the steering wheel. So had to wait till, you know. Months later. I actually wrote part of it on a plane. I forgot where I was flying, but I started the song and then I had to fly somewhere the next day. And I already had the melody, and so I was sitting on the plane and I wrote the rest of the song, you know.
So you wrote a song about 30,000 feet.
Yeah.
About the primordial soup of the Mississippi Delta.
Yeah, yeah.
A crouton in the primordial soup of the Mississippi Delta. I mean, talking of geography and, you've kind of moved around quite a bit, really, and to places. I've been to the United States a number of times, but, you know, they all seem rather distinct places. I mean, I think New York and San Francisco are very different places. Perhaps there's a certain degree of liberalism in both cities in terms of, you know, they're both, or were, certainly were, vibrant cultural centres at one point.
Oh, yeah.
I know that San Francisco has become a little bit more homogenized than it was, and a little bit more gentrified, perhaps certain areas have, you know.
Yeah.
And the same can be said of the United States. You have the sort of gentrification of Brooklyn and so on.
You know more about this than I do.
Okay, all right. But, I mean, imagine you lived in Los Angeles for quite a long time.
Yes.
And then moved to Florida. I mean, do you think that this, you know, these kind of changes are mirrored in the way you kind of write and perform and so on? Do you think, or, you know, obviously the reason you move is because you've changed in yourself, which is, I suppose, a natural thing to occur. But does geography have a particular kind of resonance with you? You know, and I mean, I just imagine the landscape is different, and it does inform you somehow.
Yeah, you've asked actually a lot of questions. I think I can answer all of them. First of all, the cities that I lived in by choice, especially New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco. I moved there because of music, and music was part of being very, liberal, liberated kind of, environment, the cities, you know, very interesting cities. You know, I imagine in some ways, I like London for that reason too, you know, where it's a creative center, you know, and where you have a creative center, I think you have very, very open-minded people. Mm. You can't be creative if you're not open-minded, as far as I'm concerned. The move that we made to Florida was, I never really liked Los Angeles. That's where I worked. It's kind of a scuzzy city, I think. It's not really pretty. I don't know if you've ever been there.
I've been through it.
Yeah. Now, San Francisco is just beautiful.
Well, San Francisco is kind of, it's easier to know that city. I know it's quite big, but it's easy to walk it and to get a sense of it.
Yeah, well, actually, San Francisco really isn't that big because it's a peninsula, it's pretty limited to growth. I mean, you know, zero growth. I mean, it's all filled up, basically. And also, they have a sense of heritage where they have a lot of buildings that are, you know, been restored and been around for a long time. We're in Los Angeles. During the 20 years I was there, I saw a couple of incarnations on the same piece of property you know, a building is knocked down and then they build a, you know, one thing and then 10 years later they build something else. So, yeah, there's no premium put on that kind of thing. In fact, just to get off real this thing real quick, there was the first movie studio, which was this old wooden structure that dated back to the Silent Age, was stuck on this piece of property somewhere. I guess maybe that's where it originally was, and the city built up around it. And then there were plans to tear down. Here it is, Los Angeles, which is the heart of the movie industry. And you have this gem, the first, you know, movie studio, which is a small structure, but it was the first. Mm-hmm. You'd think there would be a, you know, pride in that and a feeling to keep it. Well, they were going to knock it down. So then there was this movement by citizens to save it. So they did save it and actually moved it to another location. But that's the way LA is. You know, they don't. It's like it's a city with no past. It's you just kind of use the place.
Well, it's a massive urban conurbation, isn't it?
You know? It's a real sprawl.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's the other problem with it. It seems to be kind of intangible because there's just so much of it.
It's very impersonal. Mm. Yeah. Anyway, so the move to Florida was partially to get out of that scene, but to stay in a warm climate. And my wife was in the TV business and she got an offer to do some work out there, so we moved. I wasn't playing music that much then. It really didn't matter. But what's interesting is all seven of the CDs and most of my writing has been done in Florida.
Okay, right. So it was a real kind of a bit of a sort of cultural renaissance for you personally then, Florida. I mean,
it's very different.
Yeah.
The one house that we lived in for many years was on a lake, which is not uncommon in Orlando, Florida. There are lakes all over the place. And we had alligators in there. And you know, there's you take it for granted after a while, but also sometimes you say, wow, there's an alligator on my lawn. You know, that's really cool. Mm. You know, they didn't bother you.
Yeah, right.
They were very timid on one hand, but also very smart. And they've been around since dinosaurs, and they know how to take care of themselves, you know.
Yeah.
They're really the beautiful animals.
There's a few deaths recently. I'm sure they occur every summer. I think water levels sort of decline slightly, so they start to come more inland.
I don't think it's that so much. They found there's a couple of reasons why the alligators will attack people. One is if their food supply kind of dwindles. The other thing is it's against the law to feed the alligators because they lose their fear of people. And sometimes once they lose their fear of people, then they'll go after you. They have no qualms about that if they're. But, you know, you hear all the time about people, dogs and cats disappearing, you know. I mean, that's the reality that happens. And we had one alligator on our lake in our little community, and somebody complained to the county about it, and they took it out and killed it.
Really?
Yeah, which is terrible. I didn't know they would do that. I'm thinking, you know, if I had a dog, it's my responsibility to take care of my dog. And when my daughter was just a little kid, you know, I felt like, you know, I watched out for her. I didn't let her out on the lawn. You know, I mean, you know, the alligators, that's we have to share that land with them. You know, we tend to, as human beings, think that we own the place anyway. Mm. We're just another species, you know, but we don't think that way. You know, everything's got to go, you know, so we can move in, you know. So that's a wrong attitude, you know. Mm. And I've seen Florida is now the third most populated state. And
largely by the elderly, I would imagine.
There's a lot of retirees. There's a lot of retirees there. But now there's a lot of corporations and things, all kinds of stuff moving there. But as it develops, you can see the wildlife disappearing. We used to have these big sandhill cranes on our lawn. Those things probably are about 4 foot tall, and their wingspan was probably about over 6 feet. Beautiful birds, and they come up. You can feed them. You're not supposed to feed them either, but you know, people did. But we noticed that they didn't come around much anymore, and then they stopped coming around. They moved to places that were, you know, more remote, you know. So that's disappearing. So the beauty of Florida, as far as I'm concerned, is being hauled away in dump trucks, you know, and it's being replaced by amusement parks and T-shirt factories and silly things, you know. But that's where I live, and probably will remain there unless somebody would have to pull me away from there.
Hopefully not an alligator. But I mean, it seems symptomatic of certainly the Bush regime's sort of policy towards lots of things, but nonetheless seems to be symptomic of the general perception of the ecology in the United States and the environment in general.
I'm not a Bush fan, but I couldn't blame all of that on him. That's just the American way. you know, capitalism and progress and all that kind of stuff, what we call progress, you know. I mean, that's another reason I like to come over here to England, because I really enjoy the history and the heritage and the fact that people honor that to a great degree. I'm sure not everybody, but, you know, people are people. But it seems
it's happening here, though. You know, towns and cities get more and more homogenized, look more more like each other. Smaller stores go.
Yeah, that that happens. But but hopefully that you know, there's still a sense of that connection to history, and hopefully some of those buildings will remain. But yeah, things just get knocked down in the States. There are some communities though that found that if they rebuild their you know, town center and fix up the old buildings, there's actually an appeal.
Absolutely,
You know, so there's people are starting to realize that too. But yeah, I mean, we're pretty much progress, go for it, and you know, that kind of thing.
Okay, well, Bob, we'll leave it on that note, talking about the current state of America's ecology and its urbanization and industrial development plans. We didn't expect to get there, but needless to say, we'll end on a track which comes from, again, the Velvet Hand, which is a collection of Bob Rafkin's instrumentals, performed with an ensemble of John Marsden, Nestor Torres, Cadillac Cardarelli, Doug Stock, and John Henry Gates. And we're going to listen to It's Time to Say Goodbye, because it is. If you want to find out more about Bob Rafkin, Bob, where do we go?
The website is Bob Rafkin, B-O-B-R-A-F as in Frank, K-I-N.com, BobRafkin.com.
Bob, pleasure to talk to you. Hopefully you'll be back in the UK in the near future, and perhaps we can have you back and do some stuff live in a studio or whatever.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, here we go with It's Time to Say Goodbye, and as I say, it is. My name's Richard Thomas. This is Resonance 104.4 FM. Goodbye.